Welcome to the Thatched House Tavern. This is Burke, and I'm with another friend to talk about things, and his pseudonym is Patrick Henry. So why do you like Patrick Henry as your pseudonym?
Well, one, thank you for having me on, Edmund. One, I like Patrick. Patrick Henry is probably my favorite founding father. I loved his elegance. I loved the fact that he opposed the ratification of the Constitution and debated Madison in doing so, and actually he boycotted the Constitutional Convention himself, even though he was invited as a delegate. And I think that he truly shows conviction for small government at a point in time when the nation was effectively undergoing a coup. And, you know, he's kind of a rebel and a founding father that's, even though pretty well-known, of the well-known ones, not as well-known. I've always found him very interesting.
All right, awesome. Thank you for sharing that with us. So the topic for today is the Black Lives Matter website. And a lot of commentators have gone through this website and, you know, been outraged and horrified. But there's a certain degree where you can look at something that seems crazy and call it crazy over and over and over again, and it just becomes numb to it. You become numb to the fact that these ideas seem insane, and no matter how many times you say that the ideas are insane, that people still are believing them and supporting them. So instead, what I want to do is break down the ideas behind what they're saying, why they're saying what they're saying, why they're doing what they're doing. In fact, I'll often hear conservatives try to grasp how someone could believe something that they believe is so fundamentally wrong. But these people are actually consistent in a lot of their views. There's an ideology here that underlies what they're believing. And so I think it's helpful to look through it and say, okay, here's where it comes from, and here's why in their worldview it's not only consistent for their perspective, but it also makes total sense to them. They think we're the crazy ones. So having said that, let's start looking at the points. So I broke down the outline of the website where they say what they believe in, and I have a few comments here and there, so I'll just walk through it today. So they open up saying, the Black Lives Global Network is as powerful as it is because of our membership, our partners, our supporters, our staff, and you. Our continued commitment to liberation for all black people means we are continuing the work of our ancestors, fighting for our collective freedom because it is our duty. And so there's a theme word I want to point out here, and it's the theme of collectivism. It's not about the individual. It's about the group identity. Who you are as an individual person doesn't matter. What matters is what group you're a part of. So that's the one theme to look through.
I will add that at first, it appears like any other organization. Like, organizations want to make the members that are part of them, their supporters, feel like they're included. And so that, you could at first glance see that as the explanation for all the hours and the yous and so forth. But I think the fact that they choose to use collective freedom, and which would obviously contrast with individual freedom, is telling in a meticulous word choice. And I also think that obviously we are familiar with Black Lives Matter as an organization and as a movement. So obviously there is collectivism that underpins it.
Yeah, exactly. And once you understand that, I'm going to do a future episode just comparing and contrasting collectivism versus individualism, because I think that's one of the most important idea clashes that we see today. So the next thing they say is, every day we recommit to healing ourselves and each other, and to co-creating along comrades, allies, and family, a culture where each person feels seen, heard, and supported. And this is a lot of interesting word choices. They talk about healing ourselves and each other, co-creating, and comrades, allies. A lot of this is a very emotional appeal, and it's not necessarily appealing to any kind of truth statement or truth value. It's simply talking about a very emotional, feeling-based, here's why we need to do this. I don't really see them identifying anything. And to be fair, they don't necessarily need to identify anything specifically here.
Sure.
But you sort of see the already groundwork being laid for a very experience-based kind of ideology. And also notice the imagery they say. Healing, co-creating, allies and comrades. This is Marxist imagery and collectivist imagery, because Marxism is a form of collectivism.
Yeah, the fact that they say comrades is obviously, again, meticulous word choice. And of course, we've all encountered this, right? Like, if you're trying to talk to someone who is not only black, but also believes the Black Lives Matter narrative, you can kind of try to say, it was like, oh, well, how do you know it's really racism or whatever? Or you can even try to bring up statistics and so forth. But then what happens is they say, oh, well, you don't know what it's like to be pulled over, right? You don't know what it's like to walk through the mall and be followed by the security the entire time. And of course, the insinuation is that it was because of the color of their skin. And then we can say, well, you can't prove that, but it emotionally feels better for them to believe their interpretation of their experience.
Well, yeah, not only that, but there are people that have been pulled over by the police and have been followed through the mall by security of all skin types, but it doesn't matter. Like, I could put 7 white people and 7 black people in the mall and, like, have each of them get followed by security just as an experiment. Yeah. And the way that the black people will interpret that situation will be radically different. And so because it's all experience-based, it's all based on the subjective feeling of how things are. Perception has become the reality.
Yeah. And I will say, like, I've been pulled over and the cops been very rude to me before. But I can't say that's racism because, plot twist, I'm not black, right? but, like, that same cop could be having, because it was in the morning, he could be having that same bad morning. And he could pull over a black guy, and the black guy is going to leave after he's dismissed by the cops, thinking, oh, wow, he was rude to me because I'm black.
They've already started from the position, we talked about this in the victimhood article, of victimhood. This isn't to say, again, we don't want to fall into the same trap of collectivism. This isn't saying that every single black person feels this way.
Yes.
But it's clearly what Black Lives Matter feels and how Black Lives Matter betrays things. And that's the problem is... everything is already read through the lens of the assumption is given. There is racism that is causing this. Yes. And it doesn't matter whether or not racism is. And it's not to say racism never does cause that. But in the events when racism doesn't cause these interactions, even in those instances, there is still the perception that it is racism because that's the assumption. Going on to the next point, they say we acknowledge, respect, and celebrate differences and commonalities. And I just found this part laughable because they really don't. This organization has been anything but tolerant. Why has every company that has not posted in solidarity with Black Lives Matter been harassed and canceled?
Yeah, one of, I think, the worst aspects of this movement is the embrace of, like, being silent is being part of the bad side. And to be fair, like, that's even kind of Martin Luther King Jr. talk. Like, the hottest place in hell is reserved for those who stay neutral in times of great moral conflict. And I just disagree with that because, I mean, especially when they dismiss your opinions anyways, and if you have a position that's counter to them, it might not even be helpful sometimes in the workplace or in real life to be outspoken. Like, there are things that transcend, I think, politics and political movements, and it can be very helpful to just, you know, sit back and know that your opinion's not everything and be silent. And I just think it is such a contempt for the average individual person in, like, middle America who's just trying to live out their life. It shows such a contempt for those types of people to say that silence within itself is dangerous.
Yeah, I agree. And what's so sinister about that is it reminds me of this clip, I think it's from Seinfeld, where this guy is doing a march in this AIDS march and he refuses to take the ribbon. He's marching, or don't mind you, he's already marching in support of AIDS treatment. But because he refuses to wear the ribbon, a mob ends up cornering him in an alleyway and beating him up because he won't wear the ribbon. And when they're asking him, why aren't you wearing the ribbon? His response was simple. I don't want to be compelled to wear anything. And so when I read this, where this is we respect and celebrate differences, they don't even respect it, much less celebrate it. And if you don't believe this, just look about how members of this movement treat conservatives who are African-American, like Thomas Sowell, Larry Elder, and people like that.
Sure, yeah.
There's an utter contempt. Even Tim Scott, the senator who's Republican, has been called an Uncle Tom multiple times. And so
I would actually assume that it wouldn't be even Tim Scott, it would be especially Tim Scott.
True, that's a fair point. And so they put in this language, but we see their actions don't line up with their words. So the next thing they say is, we work vigorously for freedom and justice for Black people and by extension, all people. I thought this was really interesting because All Lives Matter as a response to Black Lives Matter has been heavily criticized. And it seems that some of these points here that they're making are implicitly trying to criticize, if not explain away, the All Lives Matter slogan. It's like All Lives Matter apparently was some super effective counter-propaganda. And so a lot of the Black Lives Matter points here kind of implicitly address that All Lives Matter response. So they're saying by addressing freedom and justice for Black people, they are, by extension, doing it for all people.
Yeah, because they're saying, and one, there's actually a point later that will tie back into the All Lives Matter concept. So we'll revisit it. But what they're saying is, if we end systemic racism, right, we're getting at the core of society's problems. And so that's actually, by the way, a move on their part to make the Black Lives Matter narrative one of the most important issues. Because they're saying that, you know, this is at the systemic, it's at the center. It ultimately, even though it affects Black people disproportionately, it has an effect on all people and so forth. And so they're trying to increase the importance of their movement is what they're doing.
Yeah. And something else that you can look at here, kind of building off your point, is this goes into another ideological difference. We talked about collectivism. Another one is the idea that all problems are caused by systems, not people. All the problems are caused by capitalism or by systemic racism or by some institution. It's not that people cause the problems. If we just solve the system and the institution, all the problems would go away.
Yeah. And that's very, and you mentioned Marxism earlier. That's very Marxist, right? So Karl Marx, brief summary, he believed that capitalism was at the core of society's issues. So then when you removed capitalism, people were no longer greedy. And there was, the in Marxist ideology, you can remove the institution system that we exist in, and because basically it's a nurture-based system as opposed to nature-inborn. And so they think that when you replace it with this communal society, this communist society, right, where we're all sharing everything, then everybody's going to be getting along peaceably and we'll live in a utopian society.
Yeah, exactly. And it completely undermines the idea that individuals can make corrupt decisions because they are bad, because they are evil.
Yeah.
It completely destroys that idea. And so actually, this already kind of ties into the next point where they say we intentionally build a nurture, a beloved community that is bonded together through a beautiful struggle that is restorative, not depleting. And I think what we just said right there really explains that comment, the underlying Marxist communal mindset that exists there, that if the community was changed, the problems would go away entirely. Despite the fact that in every single, if you study history, there has been no perfect society. No society has been flawless and without evil people. And there have been many different systems tried. Communism has been tried. Monarchism has been tried. Capitalism has been tried. And all the systems, guess what? What's the commonality? Evil men like to exploit things. It's not the system that's flawed. It's men that compose the system.
I would also like to make the point, and this is not probably a very profound point. This is a very vague statement of beliefs, right? Like, what? I don't even really know what this sentence means. We intentionally build and nurture a beloved community that is bonded together through a beautiful struggle. That is restorative, not depleting. And they're not, it's like they're intentionally not defining an object here. And so I don't know what they're restoring really or what they're depleting. I can guess it's inequalities and races. But I just want to say this statement of beliefs is garbage even from a grammatical standpoint.
Yeah, I think a lot of the reason for that is, so a lot of people are accused of dog whistles. And I kind of hate that phrase because it's like, you know, for some reason that there's this whole secret cabal of racists watching TV just waiting for one word to be said. And they're like, ah, they said it. But in reality,
I just heard about 15 racist dog whistles in what you just said, man.
Yeah, exactly. So, so I don't like using the term dog whistle, but there are, I'll maybe say, signal flares to anyone who is like a Marxist reading this. A Marxist reading this is going to recognize a lot of the vocabulary being used, especially like comrades is an obvious one.
Yeah.
But there's also the things talking about what did we say earlier. Let me scroll up really quick. They talk about our collective freedom. They talk about the work of our ancestors, you know, co-creating alongside comrades, vigorously work for freedom and justice.
They mentioned community. Well, that's an obvious one.
Yeah, community. The restorative struggle is another idea of communism. The fact that there's a struggle, ultimately, of the working people.
Oh, yeah. I didn't even pick up on that. That's good.
Yeah, so that's why when you read this, a Marxist is reading this going, oh, yeah, this makes sense. A conservative is reading this going, what the heck does this any of this mean?
Yeah, through a beautiful struggle. Okay.
Yeah, restorative, not depleting, because the struggle in Marxism is supposed to. So in Marxist philosophy, Marx believed that ultimately when capitalism would fall, but it's going to fall through a revolution. The workers of the world unite is his famous ending quote from the Communist Manifesto.
What
that means is that the workers are going to band together. They're going to organize. That's why organized labor has been called communist, because it's actually something that Marx argued for. And so the goal is a struggle that will overturn the current system and replace it with let's just use their own words, a beautiful restorative system that won't deplete anything. Because again, depleting, what do they think capitalism does? Capitalism depletes people, it depletes resources, it hurts people by exploiting them. So going on to their next little line, they say, we are unapologetically black in our positioning. In affirming that Black Lives Matter, we need not qualify our position. Interesting statement there. To love and desire freedom and justice for ourselves is a prerequisite for wanting the same for others. And
by the way, the we need not qualify our position after saying Black Lives Matter, that's the best part of this entire statement.
Because they go on to qualify their position. The next sentence is them qualifying the position Black Lives Matter.
Well, actually, I was thinking what they're doing is they're trying to get rid of the All Lives Matter argument. When I said earlier they mention All Lives Matter again later, this is it. We need not qualify a position after saying Black Lives Matter. So they're basically saying, and you hear this a lot, it's like, why can't you just say Black Lives Matter? Why is that so hard? With the implication being that you who are refusing to say Black Lives Matter deny, in fact, that black lives actually do matter. And it's not, they're not at all engaging really with the actual argument of all lives matter. Now, I think there are actually, by the way, a quick aside, I think there actually are good arguments against all lives matter from someone who would support a Black Lives Matter position. And I think there's counter arguments to those good arguments as well. But I, too many people, including apparently Black Lives Matter Global Network themselves, want to just dismiss it by saying, oh, we don't have to qualify our position.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's interesting. I want to kind of dig into what they said here. To love and desire freedom and justice for ourselves is a prerequisite for wanting the same for others. It's kind of backwards there. Wanting the good of others, I just forgot his name. The famous political philosopher that believes in positional ethics, where you think of how you would want to live if you were born in someone else's position, and that's the justice. That's what Alan Dershowitz advocates for it, but there's a specific philosopher behind him. Rawls. It's Rawls. I believe I said that. Because what the argument is if so, let's say that you don't know what you're going to be born as.
Okay.
You're going to either be a woman or black or white or any of those things. And so the idea is design a system so that no matter what you're born as, it's still good. You still will have a good life. You're equal. Your rights are protected. Don't design a system that just happens to benefit what you happen to be born as. And so the idea of that, and that's what Alan Dershowitz would really defend, is by wanting the good of others, of everyone to be equal as individuals, by implication, that does lead to justice for yourself by implication. But remember, this is collectivism. So collectivism doesn't care about the individual. It cares about the group.
Yeah.
And so there can be a system where all individuals are protected, but collectivism doesn't care about that, because as long as the group is in some way, there's any disparity, regardless of the causes, that's wrong for collectivism.
Yeah. And kind of what you're having is, like what you said, you're basically requesting your own needs kind of selfishly before you're looking out for others. And what that's creating is it's creating a people that conservatives would call victimhood culture, right? Where it's very easy, I think, if you're black, to want to say, oh, yeah, I believe Black Lives Matter. How come people can't say All Lives Matter? Yeah, the cop was rude to me when he pulled over. I think there's systemic racism. I must be treated unfairly. Yeah, I'm being treated unfairly. The government owes me things. Like, that line of thought, that progression, is probably more logical than we give it credit. Obviously, it's based off of false premises, but...
But once you accept those premises, it makes sense.
Yeah, and then it's like, okay, well... And you even see, like, black Christians that think that the white community is like, we believe in forgiveness, right? So the white community did wrong to the black community, so therefore, we need forgiveness. They need to seek our forgiveness, right? And it makes sense almost to a certain point, and then you realize that there are values such as selflessness and serving others and not being the victim. But then they claim, oh, well, that's, you know, privileged, right?
Yeah, exactly. I can also say when they say this, they're not understanding that collectivism, this fundamental ideology, that was the same ideology that created and enabled race-based slavery. So race-based slavery was the idea of, so for some quick history, slavery didn't exist in Europe in terms of what we understand as slavery during the Middle Ages, because the Catholic Church was really against slavery. They couldn't find a way to justify enslaving people. They would say it was against the Bible. Now, when African slavery came along, it was kind of almost like a loophole that African Americans, that's when people talk about, they're like, oh, well, they viewed them as subhuman. It was to get around the Catholic theonomy that said that you couldn't enslave your fellow man. So there was a loophole that they were trying to exploit to get away with that.
Okay.
But that's still collectivism. That was how they got away with it, is they put them in a collective and they said, well, this collective group is enslavable. That's how we get around the Catholic theonomy. And instead of dismantling this toxic ideology of collectivism, which is things, point to everything that you would call racist and horrifying in America, and you can find collectivism at the root of it. The internment camp of Japanese, what was that? Collectivism. Trail of Tears, collectivism. So anything that these people would point to and say that was horrible and that was racist, well, that was caused by collectivism. And so for now them to try to take the same ideology and try to use it to then say, well, we're just going to make it for ourselves now, totally undermines. The best way to refute it is individualism, not collectivism.
To paraphrase the, and I say paraphrase because I'm sure I'm going to butcher the quote, the very famous Ayn Rand quote, right? I believe the government should protect the minority. And the smallest minority I can think of is the individual.
Yes. And so that's why, that's one of the problems there. And so some of the points where I think we can skim through some of them because we'll end up repeating ourselves. Because, for example, they say, we see ourselves as part of the global black family. And we are aware of the different ways we are impacted or privileged, that's really interesting, as black people who exist in different parts
Actually,
of the world.
We need to talk about this
one. Yeah, this one for sure. Because notice how they say privileged. Because remember, everything's about the system. So it doesn't matter. So in some systems, they're going to argue that they're privileged. I don't know if they would say which systems they would argue that. They'll say it here, but I would love for them to say what system black people are privileged, because I can't think of one where they would admit that. Because if you go to Africa, Africa was colonized. So there's still white privilege in Africa. You go to South Africa, even though the dominant power is African-American in South Africa, they would still say that the white people are privileged because of colonialism. So I actually don't know. Do you know of any country where they would say black people are truly privileged?
I don't know. I mean, it would probably depend on the individual Black Lives Matter spokesperson or whatever.
Yeah.
But not all African countries were colonized.
Well, true. Well, that's a fact, but not everyone would know. Good luck getting that fact past certain people.
Yeah. And so, and I actually think, like, it's interesting that they're calling for solidarity, right? Because this is what that is. They don't use the word solidarity, but they're calling for it. And, even though you're right, they do have the word privileged in there, they're apparently all in this struggle together, right? Because we see ourselves as part of the global black family. Well, what's the one? What's at the core of black identity, right? Is it just the fact that, is it just their skin color? Because they sure don't share all the same culture all around the world.
Yeah.
Famously, obviously, Africans and African Americans don't get along. Like, Africans that live in America and African Americans, don't.
Yeah, Black Americans versus African Americans.
Yes. Well, yeah. No.
And Caribbean Americans too. Caribbean Americans, like from Jamaica and Haiti as well.
Yeah, they're a third group.
Yeah.
The and so when they come up, when they're all existing in the same country, they don't necessarily get along. And I wouldn't want to see a Black person go out and go to a African country. They get to choose, right? I'm not going to place them in one against their will, but they can go and they can choose the country. And I'm sure there's going to be huge cultural differences. So is it that the group identity is based in skin color? Okay, well, why?
Mm.
And not, or is it based in something like victimhood, or based in like some sort of like I'm oppressed type narrative? But again, like, you go to South Africa, the Black people in South Africa are oppressing the whites.
Yeah.
I understand that wasn't true a few generations ago, but it's sure true now.
Yeah. And I think another interesting thing to point out about that is in Brazil, I saw this video, I think it was by BuzzFeed or something, I was talking about how in Brazil, there's Brazilians, but there's different shades. You can meet a Brazilian person who looks very white.
Oh,
is 100% ethnically Brazilian. Same thing, Brazilian person who almost looks Black. And again, 100% ethnically Brazilian. And they're talking about this discrimination that was occurring between different colors of skin. And so at first you're like, oh, racism. But they didn't call it racism. They called it colorism. Like, they made up a new term because they've already co-opted racism to mean something different. But I just thought it was really interesting because it's not about culture. It's just they've picked melanin as the dominant factor for determining privilege, which is really interesting. And it actually makes sense in their worldview, because in their worldview, there's power structures. Everything's determined by power structures. The dominant power structure in the world is WASPs, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. Well, actually, I have two more things. Cisgendered heterosexual Protestants.
Sure.
That's the
I would hope Protestants would be heterosexual.
Yeah.
But
we're going to get some like angry, like some person messaging asking to explain that.
so, I hope so.
Just go read that.
I'll reply. I'll say it's from
read
Patrick Henry.
I was going to say read the Nashville statement. But that they believe that power structure is what rules the world. So it doesn't matter. As long as you're not, anytime you don't match those like points of white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, straight Protestant,
sure,
whatever, then suddenly you now have a privilege point, so to speak. You have more moral authority. And so that's why they want to unite everyone. Because it doesn't matter that they're all unique individuals, like that every culture is unique. Collectivism demands that everyone be part of the collective, that all things join together. And so that's where you find the weird, you know, you talk about the different cultures. Well, the cultures must give way to the fact that they're Black.
Yes.
Which I thought was interesting. So that kind of answers this, the next part where they say, we are guided by the fact that all Black lives matter, regardless of actual or perceived sexual identity, gender expression, economic status, ability, disability, religious beliefs or disbeliefs, immigration status or location. It's the whole WASP thing. And by WASP thing, again, it's the power structures. If you look through this list, it's all things that don't line up with the WASP WASP power structure. Therefore, they want to be in solidarity. It's whatever. It's a very anti-this movement.
Hey, technically, George Washington was a disabled WASP.
He was disabled?
Well, depending on how you define the word disabled,
because of his teeth. His teeth. Because he had
impediment.
Teeth.
That's why he had the shortest inaugural address.
Oh. Fun fact, and the guy who had the longest one died like 30 days after from pneumonia.
Good. No one wanted to hear that.
What was it? It was like Pierce Buchanan. No. It was actually before Tyler.
It was William Henry Harrison.
Yes.
I guarantee you.
Yes, it was Harrison.
I know that as fact.
So then this is all the conservative people I've noticed talk about these two points right here. And they really freak out over it. But again, once we've understood the worldview, it makes sense that they'd say this. Doesn't make it right, but it makes sense that they'd say this. We make space for transgender brothers and sisters to participate and lead. We are self-reflexive and do the work required to dismantle cisgender privilege and uplift Black trans folk, especially Black trans women who continue to be disproportionately impacted by trans antagonistic violence. Taking apart all the buzzwords there, again, if anyone's listening and has no idea what cisgender means, it just means you're not transgender. What it's saying is that, again, remember, their power structure is white, straight, heterosexuals. So they're trying to now take this other group that ironically has nothing implicit to do with Black Lives Matter. The number of people are transgender is already a very, very slim minority of the population. But it's all about this collectivism. As many people as you can get in your collective, ironically, the more power your collective has before you start eating yourself alive by doing more tribalism, which inevitably happens in any kind of collectivist society. And so same thing. We build a space that affirms black women. And so these things are all part of that. Remember, the power structure. That's what's going on under here.
Yeah. And if I may make a comment, remember that there is a political nature to this, right? The Black Lives Matter, even though it does not have a perfect relationship with, say, the Democratic Party and so forth, a lot of people within the movement would support, say, the presidency of Barack Obama. And you see this in politics. You see this kind of rainbow coalition ideology where it's like, okay, if we can get all the minorities, all the factions, we can have a majority of minority. And that's kind of what they're going for. They're wanting to include all these different facets of oppression, right? And so they can get all these different groups. So eventually they can have, you know, the 51% that's all made up of individuals that's like, yeah, I'm also oppressed. Or people that are, you know, in the privileged group that say, yeah, I empathize with these people that are oppressed.
Yeah. And so the next part of this is we practice empathy. We engage comrades with the intent to learn about and connect with their contexts. This one sentence seems really minor, but I think it's one of the most important sentences, and here's why.
Okay.
This sentence shows the subjecting of reality to the subjectiveness of experience. It's all about the experience. To learn about and connect with their contexts. Because you have to realize, this is another big ideology, there is no objective truth in morality, in beauty, in morality, and in truth. There is no objective reality there. And so, because there's no objective reality, it's all about the lens of your experience and your context. Sure, yeah. So it's not that I can say this is wrong because of my race or my gender. Automatically, what I say is wrong because my experience is fundamentally tainted. My experience makes my view irrelevant and corrupts it.
Yeah, it's kind of tied into both Marxism and postmodernism. Very quick, simplified history of idea lessons. Marxism basically said that we can't trust a lot of facts and science and literature, right? Because it's bourgeoisie.
That's the ruling class.
Yeah, it's the ruling class. It comes from the oppressors, and therefore they are manipulating and forming the facts. And once people rise up and once we implement socialism, communism, whatever, then we will understand truth, right? So then after socialism, right, was essentially proved wrong, and there was actual, like, such as the USSR, there's actual examples of people trying to implement socialism. Yeah. The left, the old left went away, and the new left came up. And
the neo-Marxists.
And they created postmodernism, right? Again, this is simplified. And so postmodernism is saying, well, there's no truth, right? I have my truth, you have your truth. But now there's kind of this, like, post-postmodernism, you can call it the Frankfurt School is the actual term for it, where it's basically saying that it's kind of redoing the whole Marxist thing. It's like you can't trust the truth that comes from the oppressors, but it's like you can't trust the narrative of essentially the white man, right? And it's the Black Lives Matter, and we all have our own experiences. And it's also, by the way, an ingenious marketing tool.
Oh, very smart. Because
you can say, hey, we want to listen to you. People like being listened to. A lot of people aren't convinced with facts and logic.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I think another part of this, first of all, you can see the communism, because again, what do they say? We engage with comrades. That's already a signal flare, which is just a better way of saying dog whistle, to understand the communist thing there. And I think it's also important to understand the idea of, like you said, Marxism said that the truth is tainted, the facts and science are tainted by the ruling class.
Yes.
Which is silly, But it's genius because then their position is de facto true. The old logic of he who asserts must prove is gone. Sure. It's our thing is true, and the only reason you can't prove that we're true is because you're tainted. So you can't even prove them wrong. If you prove that logic and science don't back them up, it's not because they're wrong. It's because you're tainted by bourgeois, upper class, or in this case, racist or sexist science. It's non-falsifiable. And then the next part is what everyone really lost their minds over. I'm going to read both of the sections.
Okay.
We make our spaces family-friendly and enable parents to fully participate with their children. We dismantle the patriarchal practice that requires mothers to work double shifts, and that's in quotes, so that they can mother in private even as they participate in public justice work. We disrupt the Western prescribed nuclear family structure requirement by supporting each other as extended families and villages, again in quotes, that collectively care for one another, especially our children, to the degree that mothers, parents, and children are comfortable. Now, everyone quotes these two things to show how bad the Black Lives Matter organization
are. And they should.
They should. But you shouldn't be certain. If you've already understood the communism and the collectivism, it totally makes sense. If you've ever read The Giver, in The Giver, they still have family units, so they would disagree with this. But it is a village mentality. If you want a children, you apply for children, and they give you children that are raised by the community.
This is straight out of the Communist Manifesto. Like, in the Communist Manifesto, Marx wants to abolish the family. And because he sees it as a symbol, he sees it as way more than a symbol, but he sees it as basically a product of the ruling class. And it's actually kind of funny. He, in the Communist Manifesto, is like, well, they're hypocrites anyways, because all the rich people are sleeping with each other's wives. But in this kind of context, they're basically, like you said, WASP. Like, Protestants love marriage. I mean, I guess Catholics do too, but Protestants love children. Be fruitful and multiply, Genesis says, right? And so what's more anti-WASP than being anti-family, right? Within the first chapter of Genesis, and then expounded in the second chapter, God creates man and woman. When Jesus is asked about marriage, he says, have you not read that in the beginning God created one male and one female, one man, one woman?
Mm-hmm.
It's showing clear antagonism to this ruling class idea, which, as you said, is summed up in WASP.
Yeah, and it's funny because, like, families are not inherently a Western creation.
Yes.
Like, even, like, in fact, if you go to Asian cultures, the family unit's even stronger. The family unit is more dominant because it's very honor-based family culture. You must bring honor to your family. That's why Asian cultures do a way better job taking care of their grandparents than we do, because you don't just abandon your grandparents. You don't do that.
Yeah. Now, one of the problems, and you're aware of this, is Asians have a weird relationship anyways with the whole intersectional rainbow coalition stuff, right? Because, you know, when Asians come over to America, they have high incomes, they have high IQs, they graduate from good colleges. So it's more difficult to substantiate that Asians are being oppressed, right? So they don't really talk about Asians as much.
Yeah.
And but what it does do is, even though they call it a Black Lives Matter global network, obviously Black Lives Matter is a very American thing.
Yeah, incorrect. Well, it's been exported globally, but yes, it was an American export.
It started off as an American.
It's a very American export.
And so, which is funny, because you would think, it's like, wait a second, why is such an American movement? America is one of the most privileged countries on the face of the planet.
It's like we're colonizing people with our movements.
Yeah, absolutely. And so basically, they see this, how hierarchy works and how oppression works, based off of how they perceive it in their privileged position of being American.
Exactly. And that's why I think if any Christian or conservative tries to say, like, well, what's wrong with Black Lives Matter? I think the best answer I've heard recently is Black Lives Matter, but I don't support Black Lives Matter, because the organization is different from the idea. And so this is the quote everyone shows. This is about the family and the problem where they say they explicitly say they want to demolish the family. Like that is an explicit goal. It's not even couched in like vague terminology.
And I by the way, care more about that than I do care about the whole, whites are oppressing us. It's like, okay, whatever. Like they've been saying that for years. And, you know, even if we're to concede that in that people are individually racist, right?
Yeah.
Which most people do concede that. And even if we were to concede that people are systemically racist, how in the world is the answer to that we must dismantle the family?
Well, it makes sense if you're a Marxist, because Marx hates the family.
Oh, absolutely.
And so that's where it makes sense, because a conservative in this is like, what does that have to do with anything? But once you're like, wait, they're Marxist, suddenly it's like, oh, everything fits together like a puzzle then of everything they're saying.
Because the family's anti-community in some aspect, right? Because it's like individual, it's like showing preference towards one another's at this kind of deep blood level and at this deep emotional, there's a word I can't remember, like just deep
familial, I guess.
Level. And basically if you're trying to pigeonhole everything into this ideology about systems of oppression, and there's different people that kind of make inroads of society, because Marx also, no one ever talks about this, but he also advocated for, he was against the rural urban divide. And he wanted everybody to be displaced evenly across geography.
That ended real well in Cambodia.
Yeah, and so it's like, it's a bunch of things. They're just trying to take away all forms of inequality, like mother, father.
Well, not
like,
inequality, inequity. Anything that results differently.
And remember, what happens when you have a family where there's not a father figure, and you have a family that where there is a father figure, right? Which, by the way, you see,
that's actually one of the biggest privileges. You see a huge, having a stable, loving family is one of the biggest quote-unquote privileges you can have.
I would say it's a privilege. Like, I don't think privilege is a bad thing. I would want my kids, I don't have any at the moment, I would want my kids to have a father. I would want my kids to have a father who was there for them and who was serving them, who, like taught them and who spent time with them and loved them. And people that have a strong father figure are way more like less likely to end up as criminals and in prison. And the statistics for just flourishing as a human being, higher incomes, it's all there for people who had a father figure.
Yeah, exactly. And then the last two points are, they talk about the queer affirming network, and they say we foster a queer affirming network. When we gather, we do so with the intention of freeing ourselves from the tight grip of heteronormative thinking. Sidebar, the WASPs, the straight male, you know, hegemony.
By the way, WASP means white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. I don't know if we've defined it yet.
Yeah, so WASP is white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, but the idea has come to encompass white Anglo-Saxon, cisgendered, heteronormative.
Again, Protestant, right? That's all kind of incorporated.
Yeah, sure. It kind of is implied when you say Protestant because there's a whole corpus of beliefs there. And they say we cultivate in... Oh, sorry. I didn't finish the whole thing about the queer affirming network. From the tight grip of heteronormative thinking, or rather the belief that in all the world, that all in the world are heterosexual unless she/he disclose otherwise. And they say we cultivate an intergenerational and communal, again, communism language, communal network free from ageism. We believe that all people, regardless of age, show up with the capacity to lead and learn, apart from the fact that there are literally physical differences in age.
Yeah, that's probably the most confusing statement on all of this. It's like, I really don't think a 22-year-old and a 74-year-old show up to things with the same capacity to lead and learn.
I agree. And I don't think if I get someone at 20, 40, 60, 80, you will see a difference in how they act, in how they perceive, in how they're able to physically do things. That is a real difference.
Their leadership skills, their ability to learn. It's like I don't know if the person who wrote that was thinking very deeply about it. Obviously, they probably weren't. But, that's just such a silly statement.
Yeah. And it goes again to collectivism and this idea that we talked about, the intersectionality, which, again, I'll do a whole separate episode on intersectionality, but the very, very, very short version of it is whatever privilege points you... So, again, remember the WASPs? So whatever you don't match up, wherever you don't line up with a WASP, if you're not white, if you're not Anglo-Saxon, if you're not Protestant, if you're queer, you now, at the intersection of all those non-WASP characteristics you have, that basically defines the moral authority you have. So we have collectivism, we have intersectionality. So I guess to wrap up things really quick.
Sure.
We can talk. So we see that there's an idea here. There's Marxism, which is a form of collectivism. There's a denial of objective reality, which, like, people say Marx is the most influential political thinker of our day. I think it's a fair way to say that, because a lot of the things really go back to, like, communism existed pre-Marx, but Marx really Yes. revolutionized communism. He's the one who attacked the idea that science can be objective. He's the one who attacked the idea of the family. He did a lot of legwork there. And so Yeah. I encourage everyone who's reading this and going, that's insane, it can't happen. Don't just say that. Say, wait a second, this is Marxist. And once you say that, then you don't have to worry about attacking the surface level of this. You can say, wait a second, there's a deeper idea here that needs to be addressed and refuted. And once you understand that, you've taken it out at the knees. And so that's all I have to say. Is there anything you want to add as a last comment?
Yeah. Read Marx, read the Communist Manifesto, and
Believe it, just read it.
Yeah, yeah. And every time you see the word, like, bourgeois or bourgeoisie, right? Just replace that with
white,
with WASP or white, yeah. Heteronormative thinking,
yeah.
It's the same thing, just like repurposed, but in taken off of the economic
scale
and kind of
the racial
put over with this like racial cultural
yeah.
garbage.
Exactly. That's what people mean when they say cultural Marxism or racial Marxism.
Yeah.
So again, thank you so much for sitting with me here today. I really appreciate the discussion. I hope it's helpful for people that listen to it. If you want to learn more, again, the Communist Manifesto is a great place to start. And we hope that you will join us for the next episode.